So, yesterday we had a one-day sitting, and I talked about equanimity, which has been in my mind for some time, probably because my lack of it and my in certain areas, and it seems to be a topic that I've been exploring and trying to develop for myself. So I thought talking about it yesterday, and it's still on my mind, so I'd like to just kind of continue, or for those of you who were there yesterday, a lot of it would be a repeat. One of the principles that I often talk about, I think, about Buddhism, Buddhist practice, is that mindfulness has the function of in the light of mindfulness, the wholesome mental qualities grow, and in the darkness they shrink. And in the light of awareness of mindfulness, unwholesome mental qualities shrink, and in the darkness they grow. So if we're aware of, if it's wholesome, tends to grow and be nourished by that awareness, and that those things which are unwholesome, they are nourished by unawareness, by not paying attention, by letting them be kind of unconscious motivations. So one of the things to do in Buddhist practice is to become familiar with some of the mental states and qualities which maybe you're not so familiar with, some of the wholesome ones, and also some of the unwholesome ones, so you can recognize them, become familiar with them, and thereby nourish them or starve them, depending on whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, through your awareness. And in my contact with Buddhism, I was surprised to discover a range of kind of emotions or mental states that I was not familiar with, kind of just growing up. Or I kind of knew the words of them, maybe perhaps. Some of them I didn't even know the words of. For example, there are, I don't have a memorized list, but there's like five different kinds of joy that can happen in meditation. And the words, you know, we don't have words for them in English, but sometimes they're translated into English as things like, rippling joy and cascading joy and exploding joy, and there's all these wonderful kind of words for joy, different ways experienced in the body. So equanimity was one of these things that was a little bit of a surprise for me, and I knew what the word meant somewhat. And but my discovery of equanimity through the meditation practice was a real surprise, and to discover what a tremendous power equanimity is. I meet a lot of people who, when they hear the word equanimity, feel a little bit turned off by it, because for a number of reasons, I think. Perhaps because equanimity, the normal definition of equanimity is a balance of mind, an evenness of mind, ability for the mind to be balanced in the midst of success and failure, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. It's not influenced by the winds, the currents of what other people think. And the mind stays balanced. It doesn't go for or against what is going on. The awareness doesn't contract or for or against what's going on. And it can seem like kind of like a little bit dull. It can seem like there's no passion there, no life. It's just kind of a dull, kind of neutral state. And who wants to be in a kind of neutral state? You know, you want to be more excited in life. And the surprise for me in discovering equanimity through meditation practice was that it's a very strong power. It's almost, I'd venture to say, kind of like, when it's well developed, it can feel almost like a passion. It's such a strongly embodied and mental state, that kind of fills the body and mind with kind of energy and radiance, that the last thing you want to think of it is kind of like a dull, empty, kind of neutral state, even though the mind is not reacting to anything. And I think a number of people think of spirituality in terms of such emotions as joy or compassion or love, or attainment of oneness or communion with something wonderful. But very few people, I think, focus on equanimity as being a very important part of a spiritual life. You know, In Buddhism, however, equanimity is one of the prime emotions or mental states. In a number of lists, it's kind of the top of the list. Some people, you might almost come to the conclusion that equanimity is the most sublime or the highest or the most elevated or most important emotion, both social emotion between people and personal kind of state of mind to have. So I think it's well warrants a visit, kind of to explore a little bit, talk about a little bit, and make us all a little bit more familiar both with equanimity and perhaps with some of the forces that make it difficult for us to have equanimity. Because, while being familiar with it and learn to recognize and appreciate it when it appears, strengthens it. A lot of what Buddhist spirituality is about is noticing the kind of things that keep us from what the ideal is. The little saying that I borrow from William James is, if there's a gap between the actual and the ideal, choose the actual. So I think it works very well for mindfulness practice. If there's a difference between what you hoped it would happen, the ideal, and what's actually going on for you, put your attention to what actually is going on. And then through the actual, you can maybe hopefully discover the ideal. So we talk about equanimity so you can become familiar with it, but perhaps ultimately one of the more important pieces of the work is to become familiar with what keeps equanimity from happening, appreciating the possibility of it, but really kind of studying, investigating our reactivity. There's a little bit of a, I don't know if it's a really a good story to illustrate equanimity, but I tell it to you because it's a story that's most commonly taught in our tradition when people talk about equanimity, the different teachers, the Vipassana teachers. And it's used kind of to highlight its possibility. So I tell you, just not so much that the story was a good one, perhaps, but that, that it just bring you up to date. It's just a story. You probably heard a lot of it. It's a story of this barbaric general who storms into a monastery and. There's a monk sitting there, an elder monk. And the general lifts up his sword and he announces, with the intention of maybe killing the monk, I am the kind of person who can kill without blinking an eye. And the monk looks at him with a lot of equanimity or serenity, he looks at him and says, and I am the kind of person who can die without blinking an eye. And so then the general lowers his sword and becomes the disciple of the monk, supposedly. So, great equanimity in the face of danger, of even the possibility of death and dying. And even though that's probably a mythic story, a kind of made-up story, I think there's lots of examples of people who have that kind of equanimity, sometimes for the better and the worst. People who are not afraid of dying are sometimes the people you should be most afraid of. So equanimity is very useful. It's very useful for parenting, I learned after the fact. It's one of the areas where I'm struggling to find my equanimity. But I remembered I've been around a number of 4-year-olds. My son is 3.5 or so. And the surprise I had with these 4-year-olds is... the first time it happened, I was really surprised. I didn't know these things happened. But I was on this 4-year-old who, she told her mother, I hate you. And I was kind of horrified, how could that be? And it went through my mind, what kind of parenting are these people doing? But it seems to be, I don't really know these things so well yet, but it seems to me that it's a kind of stage that a lot of kids will go through. Just as my son went through a particular, expressed a kind of archetypical stage a week ago or so at home, where he announced that when he grew up, he wants to have a baby. And somehow my mother, my wife explained to him that, that he couldn't do that really on his own very well. And he needed a woman or a wife or something, woman. And he said, well, I want to have a baby with you then. And then he said, I always want to be with you. And I've heard, you know, that young boys will sometimes say, you know, I want to marry you, mommy, you know, at this age. And then, you know, 6 months later, they're saying, I hate you. And so to know these things that are coming, you know, maybe they're kind of universal patterns of some sort, very common patterns. I don't know if they're universal, but common enough in our culture. There can be much more equanimity about their appearing. And I've known that, you know, that seeing the patterns in my son has helped a lot for me to be equanimous at times where when I didn't see the pattern, I'd be, you know, my attitude was, this is forever. I don't intellectually believe that, you know, I'm not thinking that, but kind of my emotional response kind of is, this is forever. I have to live with this forever now. And actually, you know, it's just a phase, you know, it goes through a couple of days or a week or however long and, or, you know. So one of the things a couple of years ago, my wife and I would say, we'd look at each other and we'd say, we're having one of those days. And that was really helpful for me because it's just, you know, it's one of those days that happens with, you know, raising kids and it reminded me not to be a little lighter about it, to have more equanimity about it. It's just, these are kind of things that go through. I don't have to get to some big conclusion about it. Equanimity is seen as kind of the one of the highest Buddhist emotions, and one of the ways to see that is in the lists that it appears in, the list of practices or practice experiences. Most commonly, it appears in the list of the four Brahmaviharas, which are the four divine abodes, the four kind of divine or wonderful or very wholesome social emotions to be cultivated, the way we can relate to ourselves or relate to others. And these are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And the way that classically these four social emotions are cultivated as meditation practices, they're cultivated in that order. First loving kindness, then compassion, then sympathetic joy, and then equanimity. And with equanimity being last, where equanimity is building on the first three, where the first three are kind of present first, are kind of cultivated and become a strong part of who you are, and then there's equanimity that kind of integrates them or holds them all together in a balanced way. So rather than equanimity being kind of returning to this kind of neutral state, it comes along with these feelings of love and compassion, but so it's fueled by them or informed by them and an intimate part of them. I think of equanimity as a Brahmavihara as being the grandmotherly mind, where a grandmother has supposedly tremendous love for the grandchild, but has a lot more equanimity than the parents. And, you know, they've seen it all and they know it all. And, you know, the parents are fretting around, you know, so concerned. And, I mean, you should have seen us at our house, you know. you know, I think my guess is that in normal course of things, parents, when they have two children, have a lot more equanimity the second time around because, you know, you've seen it before, you know, you kind of see it coming. And, but anyway, grandmotherly mind. The other place you see it is in the list of the four absorptions. When people get very deeply concentrated in meditation, they enter what's called jhanas or the absorptions. And they also follow progression, the kind of a natural progression that the second absorption is characterized by tremendous rapture. Sometimes tremendous, can be a range of how strong it is. At some point, if a person becomes stabilized in that absorption, they're trained or they intuit that rapture is actually agitating. It's like if you get too much rapture, it's like enough of this, you know, I'm tired of it. It's kind of tiring to have all this, you know, intensity of the rapture. And people just want to get, you know, let go of it. And they're trained to let go of it in favor of the underlying, in a sense, happiness or kind of bliss that is much more satisfying than the rapture. It's not mentally so agitating as rapture can be. And then after that's stabilized in the third absorption, they're trained to see how to notice how even that wonderful sublime happiness is a little bit agitating and a little bit stressful. And, you know, after a while you get kind of tired of that. And then the meditators learn to let go of that happiness in favor of equanimity, a state of very deep equanimity. And the equanimity is experienced as much more deeply satisfying than either rapture or joy or happiness. And so, rather than being kind of a neutral, dull state, it, in contrast to rapture and joy, it's actually much, you know, it's, it has a greater satisfactory value. It's much more it's very much more satisfying. It's much more sublime and precious feeling. The other place, and there's another place equanimity appears, and that's in the so that equanimity of the absorptions is an equanimity of great concentration. When the mind is very, very has a strength of concentration, then things are not going to influence it much. You're not going to be blown over, partly because you're not noticing much. When you're deeply absorbed in the absorptions, you don't really hear things or feel a lot of things, and the mind is kind of independent of sensory input, experiences of life. And for through that independence, it can experience this great equanimity because it's not troubled by anything. It's kind of easy then, right? So then you have the list of the seven factors of awakening. And the seven factors of awakening are the seven mental states or qualities that get developed as a person approaches the experience of enlightenment. And these things, seven, need to be in balance with each other. And these are mindfulness, investigation, effort, joy, concentration, tranquility, and equanimity. And this time, even though equanimity is last, it's not because it's the highest. It's just, I don't know why they order that way, but the seven are supposed to be balanced together. And in this case, rather than letting go of joy, joy and equanimity are balanced. Joy and tranquility are balanced. Joy and the ability to investigate what's going on in the moment are balanced. So these things are what arises out of mindfulness practice rather than concentration practice. And they become very, very strong states that they don't get balanced at a low level, they get balanced at a fairly high pitch. The fourth place you see equanimity is in classic practice of vipassana. There are stages called vipassana knowledges that some vipassana students will go through. And the last stage of these vipassana knowledges, last stage of vipassana, there's either 12 or 16, 9 or 12 or 16 stages, depending on how you count, is called the equanimity towards all formations, which basically means equanimity towards anything you can experience. And this is equanimity that arises not because you're so concentrated, not because you've developed wise social understanding of how to have equanimity in relationships to other people, but rather you have equanimity because the mind is not inclined in any kind of way to be for or against what it's experiencing. So it's open to all kinds of experience, whatever's going on, but it allows it to arise there. And there's no holding on or pushing away or resisting what that experience is. And this is an extremely sublime experience to have that. It's like the mind, it's kind of like the mind is so radiant that, I don't know if the radiance is the right analogy here, but just so radiant that it's so content and so happy or so filled or so settled or so at peace with itself that it doesn't really... not influenced by anything, pain or pleasure or whatever is going on in your experience. Sometimes I call this the Teflon mind, because things just slide right off. One of the analogies used in the suttas, they didn't have Teflon back then, but they had lotus leaves, which a drop of water, they would just roll right off a lotus leaf, was an example of this kind of equanimity. And this being the last stage of vipassana, it's the stage that sets the stage for the experience then of nibbana, of the final awakening. Kind of like when the mind is so equanimous that it's not for or against anything, doesn't contract, doesn't resist anything, just allows everything to be there. The mind rests kind of in its natural radiance. Then it sets a stage for the mind to release itself. It's as if the last vestiges of clinging or holding is consciousness holding on to itself. And then it lets go of itself, and then there's the experience of nibbana. Now, most of us in the course of normal daily life are not going to have these kinds of intense experiences of equanimity, but we can have tastes of it in smaller ways. For many people, it's the first list of the Brahma-viharas, which is most important, to have equanimity in a relationship to other people. And the cultivation of such equanimity in Buddhism as a meditation practice, the Brahma-viharas are done through saying phrases that... And the phrase that's connected to the Brahma-vihara of equanimity is something like, everyone is the heir of their own karma. Everyone's happiness and unhappiness, suffering, is a result of their own decisions that they make. I might care a lot about you and want the best for you. However, I'm not responsible for the decisions you make, and decisions you make that affect your well-being or lack of it. So that's a whole topic in itself, those phrases. But that understanding someone else is responsible for their own happiness is one of the ways to develop this social equanimity in Buddhism. And I find that very helpful for me when I'm dealing with people. Like right now I'm dealing with a relative who's quite sick. And it's quite distressing for me. It's the area where I seemingly have the least equanimity is around my close relative who's so sick. And... But what I'm seeing over and over again is the degree to which, I'm doing the most I can to try to be helpful, but that she makes decisions which sometimes are her decisions. I can't stop her decision making, but she's making decisions which seem detrimental to her health, you know, her well-being. And I'm very compassionate and sympathetic to her because it's very hard for her to kind of make through her life, and she's struggling, and just her decisions she makes are just. Are probably the best she can do. But still, she's making her own decisions, and I can't get in there and make those decisions for her. And that helps me a little bit. It doesn't make me feel less, it doesn't make me feel happy. It's not like I could go home, you know, I feel a certain amount of suffering around there. But I feel equanimity, some equanimity, because I don't feel responsible. And for me, the Achilles heel of the effects, you know, that my equanimity or lack of it, is my sense of personal responsibility for other people's happiness and well-being. So when I realize that I'm not so personally responsible, that doesn't mean that I stop doing everything I can to be helpful. But if I don't feel personally responsible, then I don't have this hook in my mind where I contract or get frozen or get filled with despair or something that I might have. And I'm beginning to see that equanimity with my son. Because I had no idea that by the time someone's 3 years old, they're already becoming their own person. You know, I thought that would happen later. You know, I didn't know what I thought, but this is all new to me. But this guy's his own guy. You know, he makes his own decisions and his own. You know, there's a part of me that I'm not. You know, he's deciding for himself. You know, he's his own character. He's born with a certain personality And so, starting to see, you know, that there's a degree in which I'm not responsible for his personality and kind of his choices, even at age 3, in certain areas, gives me some equanimity so that I don't kind of riding up so close and kind of feel like, you know, I'm personally responsible and it's up to me, all these things. It's kind of, I don't know if mystery is the right word, but there's a kind of a mystery to, maybe perhaps, to raising children. In that, it seems like you're not exactly in charge. for better and worse. And in social relationships, equanimity is really important because, as the saying goes, it can take years and years to develop a good friend. And it can take moments to destroy it. If we don't have enough balance of mind, then our reactivity can get the upper hand, and we can, say something or do something which is really hurtful for the person, and then years of friendship has been erased, of trust. Some people are afraid of equanimity. Especially meditative equanimity, because to be really deeply equanimous requires letting go of concerns with me and mine, with definitions of self. And some people are very afraid to exist in any kind of way, even in deep meditative states, without the security of knowing who they are and defining themselves, protecting themselves by having a certain definition of who they are. And as long as there's some kind of definition of self or concern with me or mine, the mind is a little bit fragile. The mind actually lacks the conditions for equanimity, because you're going to be swept up by all kinds of things that threaten or support or enhance that sense of self. So one of the functions, classic definitions of equanimity, is to prevent us from falling into extremes. And some of the extremes that they talked about are what's called the eight worldly conditions, or the eight worldly winds, that if you have a strong sense of self-definition, that self-image you're holding on to, you just get blown over left and right. And these are usually listed this way: success and failure, praise and blame, gain and loss, and pain and pleasure. And these things can we can be really caught up in these kinds of things, or the mind can be equanimous about them and not think so much about it. If someone comes and praises you, you know, do you get elated? If someone comes and criticizes you, do you get depressed? Well, if someone comes and criticizes you for the zit on your nose, if you're a teenager, you get quite upset. But if you're 80 years old, you know, who could care about what people think about my zits, you know? And you're quite equanimous about it. There's no, it doesn't affect, you know, our ups and downs. And this is why I call Buddhism premature aging. Because it involves developing that kind of equanimity, where we're not caught up with all the things that are so centrally important for us earlier in life, that we use to define who we are and measure self positively and negatively. We're equanimous about praise and blame, success and failure. There's lots of success and failure as part of life, and we don't have to use it to define ourselves or to measure ourselves, and we just continue with what needs to be done. So to have equanimity about these eight worldly conditions is one of the places of equanimity. People sometimes are afraid of equanimity because it requires letting go of what we're attached to. And that's where the study of our reactivity becomes an important part of developing equanimity. What is it? What are the triggers inside of us that make it difficult for us to be equanimous? What is our reactivity in different situations? For example, for me, the sense of responsibility is one that kind of I get caught by. Other people get caught maybe perhaps by praise and blame. Other people get caught by success and failure. Other people get caught by pleasure and pain. Some people are really afraid of any kind of pain at all, or the possibility of it, and there's no equanimity about it. And some people have a lot of equanimity about it. Some people lose equanimity about what's going to happen in the future. Their mind projects into the future what's going to happen, and that makes them anxious. So I noticed that in myself, that the times where I wake up in the middle of the night or I have trouble falling asleep at night. Last night, my wife woke me up at 2:30 and said, "Oh, come and look." And so I stumbled out of bed to look out the window and see the shooting stars, and we saw some. They were quite beautiful. I'd never seen such kind of big stars, kind of shooting stars or whatever, the comets going across the sky. So it was kind of nice to see. But then I had trouble falling back to sleep afterwards. Was it worth it? But what I've noticed is, for me, is that when I have trouble sleeping, that I'm usually in the moment, in the experience itself, I'm quite happy. It's usually comfortable. I'm there in a nice, comfortable bed, and nothing's, I'm well fed and basically comfortable. That what makes my mind anxious, where I lose my equanimity about it all, serenity or peace about it, is my concerns about what it means the next day. Oh, if I'm really sleepy the next day, then I won't be able to perform the way I need to, or I'll stumble over my words, or I'll give an unintelligible Dharma talk, and everyone will reject me, Or so it's like the concern about what's going to happen in the future, that where the hook is for me, and some of it has to do with you know, self-definition and how people will see me and how successful I am in my endeavors and all these little things kind of grab me. But in the moment, there's actually nothing, it's actually quite wonderful for me, usually when I'm laying there. Sometimes I get just kind of uncomfortable. Yeah, but because we have this hard futon. So, what are the forces that make you unequanimous? What are the things that get you caught? What are the kind of reactivity that you need to study and become more familiar with so that you don't make yourself equanimous? Because you can make yourself that way artificially and be just if you do it artificially, then it becomes, I think, kind of violence to ourselves. But by understanding wisely how we get caught and be willing to be inspired to look at that, because you feel inspired by the possibility of having equanimity. You feel this is a possibility, it's potential for who you are. It's not a dull, neutral state, but it actually it's something very vital. And so you're interested in it, but you know the wise way to approach it is to use that inspiration and confidence to go and look, how is it I'm getting caught here? Do I need to be caught this way? Do I need to be for and against this kind of experience? What is it for you? The last thing I'll say is that the warning in Buddhism is that, or the teaching is that, equanimity is not indifference. It's not a kind of a neutral state where you're kind of indifferent to what's going on. Just as much as the grandmother who loves the child is filled with love and concern for the grandchild, but is equanimous about what the ups and downs of the grandchild. Equanimity is there in the grandmotherly mind, but the indifference is not there. So equanimity is not indifference, and it's also not to be confused. The warning in the text is it's not to be confused with ignorance, the equanimity that comes out of not knowing. Because if you don't know anything, then you can be quite equanimous. I'm sitting here, maybe all of you really hate this Dharma talk. It's just like the worst one you've ever heard. I'm monopolizing the conversation right now, so you don't have a chance to tell me that. So I don't know. So I can have this blissful equanimity about that because I don't know, you know. So that's not considered equanimity, just kind of the bliss of ignorance, not knowing. I don't know if that's the right example, but maybe you get the principle. So those are my thoughts and around the topic. And what I was hoping to do this morning, is we have about 5 minutes before the usual scheduled end. What I'd like to ask you, if you'd be willing to go along, is if you would, the suggestion would be, we can do one of two things. We can just have an open discussion on this topic, or to have more voices be able to talk and explore the topic. My interest was that you all form little groups of three or four, and just for 5 minutes, maybe three is a good number, just talk about this topic of equanimity, your reactions to the talk, or your reactions to how it is for you, and what you care to talk about, and what meaning this might have for you, or what are the things that make it difficult for you to have equanimity. And it doesn't have to be great deep confessions, but just in 5 minutes, just kind of explore it a little bit and see what different people around you might think about this topic. Would that be okay? Yeah. So why don't you just form little groups of three, triplets. Ken? Okay, Ken? There's two over there if you want to sit in. On the chairs? If you want, join them or Jerry and. Thank you. So knowing how to let go is an important part of equanimity. So you're more than welcome to continue the discussion after we formally end. But I just wanted to just say that we should probably end and formally. And I'll read, to end, I'll read a short quote from the Buddha that's used sometimes as a description of equanimous mind. And the Buddha was talking to his son. His son became a Buddhist monk. And he said, his son's name is Rahula. Rahula, develop an awareness that is like the earth. For on the earth, people throw clean and unclean things, and the earth is not troubled or repelled. And as you grow like the earth, no pleasant or unpleasant experiences will grab your attention or stick to it. Similarly, you should develop an awareness like water. For people throw all manner of clean and unclean things into water, and it is not troubled or repelled. And as you flow like water, no pleasant or unpleasant experience will grab your attention or stick to it. So may you be like the earth and the oceans. So thank you very much, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks.